Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Each episode is a conversation with inspiring people who make wonderful contributions to our knowledge in these areas and spark curiosity and ideas to pursue. Join me, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
If you're a writer and you really care about the message that you're putting out there, you have to remember that your job is to connect with one reader at a time. If you can make a difference to one reader, make them laugh, make them learn something, cry, whatever, then you are moving in the right direction. I think it's so much more important to focus on that connection that you have with people than to be constantly checking your reviews or checking your numbers, your sales numbers. Like, I know it's difficult not to focus on that, but if you can instead focus on that person-to-person connection, that's what matters.
Hi there, innovator. It's great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. I trust too that you enjoyed my recent conversations with Dr. Jeff Spencer of Cornerman Coaching and with Ted Rubin, social media strategist. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Amanda Turner, who writes under the name AK Turner. Amanda is a writing coach and completes an average of 2 books each year, whilst also managing to travel for 4 months of every year as a part-time digital nomad. Together with her husband and 2 young daughters, their travels have taken them from her home in Idaho, the USA, to Australia, Alaska, Mexico, Brazil, Spain, Scotland, Ireland, and Thailand. Amanda is the New York Times best-selling author of the Vagabonding with Kids series, as well as This Little Piggy Went to the Liquor Store, and Mummy Had a Little Flask, and also Hair of the Corn Dog. A quick promotional message from our sponsor, that's InnovaBiz, where we help coaches and consultants build professional credibility, engage their target audience, and connect with their ideal client. That requires absolute clarity about who your ideal clients are and how you can help them. To help you get that clarity about your ideal client, take a look at our Marketing Master Mini Class, where in less than 30 minutes, you'll gain absolute clarity on your ideal client and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. Access the Marketing Master Mini Class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and accessible without even giving away your email. In our discussion today, Amanda talked to me about the importance of your book cover and the title to capture attention from the beginning. She explained how important it was to understand your audience and to get your message in front of the right audience. And she shared a secret about focusing your writing on one reader and really focusing in building a connection with that one reader. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Amanda Turner. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Boise, Idaho in the USA, Amanda Turner, who's a New York Times best-selling author, a nonfiction writing coach, as well as a podcaster. So welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Amanda. It's a real privilege to have you as my guest.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Heather Lee Dyer, who was our guest on episode 235 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, suggested that we get you on for a conversation, Amanda. So a big shout out to Heather.
Heather is amazing. And I have a 12-year-old daughter who reads Heather's books over and over again. So I have Heather's biggest fan living in my house.
Oh, that's great. And I noticed that your 12-year-old daughter actually has her own, was it blog or a podcast where she interviews?
She's had a podcast. Yeah. And she also has a YouTube channel as well. So she's all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. We'll come back to that a little bit later. Now, Amanda, you're a former humor columnist. It's hard to say. And you've written many books, including the Vagabonding with Kids series. It's based on your own travel adventures in some way as a part-time digital nomad. So I'm kind of fascinated to explore that in some detail. And now you spend a lot of your time as a book writing coach. So I'm really fascinated to hear more about that whole story, how all that came about. So tell us a little bit about the background and give us a snapshot of some of the key moments in that journey to where you are today.
Sure. So yes, I am a writer. So that necessitates a good solid decade of waiting tables and cleaning houses, which I did before I really got my feet under me. And I'm an independent author. So I attempted to get into traditional publishing with my first book, which was This Little Piggy Went to the Liquor Store. And I actually went back and forth with an agent at Penguin for about 2 years. And I remember the day that I realized this wasn't going anywhere, this relationship, and I wasn't going to get a contract. And I eventually it felt like defeat at the time. And I eventually self-published, which also kind of felt like defeat. And then 2 years later, that book hit the New York Times bestsellers list. So, I mean, that was a big moment for me to realize that, you know, the traditional route, you can get where you want to go, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the path that you've been told is the traditional way to get there. There are many ways to get there. So I continued with that. I did a parenting humor series. I followed up This Little Piggy Went to the Liquor Store with Mommy Had a Little Flask and Hair of the Corn Dog. And so that was a 3-book series, what I call inappropriate parenting humor. And during the writing of those books, I mean, our children are 10 and 12 now. And ever since they were born, we've spent 2 to 4 months of every year living in other countries. And so when I finished up this parenting humor series, I really wanted to move more in the direction of travel. Still humor, that's sort of my home base, but I wanted to incorporate more of the travel. So yeah, we're part-time digital nomads, and so I started the book series Vagabonding with Kids about, you know, all of the times I've made a fool of myself in another country and all of those trials and what it's like to travel with kids. And then eventually I added in coaching. And so I coach writers or also work as a publishing consultant or do, say, a developmental edit on their manuscript to help them moving in the right direction. So that in a nutshell is where we are now. And my husband and I also, we have a business together and we organize mastermind retreats for couples and writers. I want to say in other countries, but really just in one other country, in Mexico. So I do a lot of different things, but writing has always been at the core of it. And yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
That's fascinating. And I guess the other theme in there, I guess there's two themes for me there that I recognize, and that's humor coming through and the writing, but also the travel part of it and the retreat business is a really natural fit for that as well, I think.
And I think humor lends itself to everything, but especially travel. Like so many people learn of what we do and they say, oh, I could never do that. And I think, as long as you have a sense of humor, yes, you can absolutely do it, you know, but just make sure you pack your sense of humor, everything else you can figure out.
Well, one of the things I find fascinating with your Vagabonding with Kids, first of all, it is available as a podcast series, or one of the books, I guess, is available as a podcasting series, which
Correct.
Is quite fascinating, read by you. So
yes.
I'd suggest people have a listen to that because it's a very entertaining listen and there are a lot of lessons in that. What fascinates me about that and about your writing style is How do you put something like that together that it's, I mean, to me, it was entertaining, humorous, but at the same time, there were some lessons there that, you know, you didn't kind of say, well, here's the lesson I learned from this, or here's the lesson you should take away from this. But the lessons were there, they were infused, they were very subtle, but they came through very strongly. How do you, is that a conscious effort to put that together, to take something that could very easily just become a travel journal? You know, we went here, we saw this, we did that, we had these issues, we dealt with them in this way, as opposed to having a really engaging story?
Well, I mean, like I said, humor is always my home base. So that's where I start. For that Vagabonding with Kids podcast, which is book one of that series, you know, it was designed, never intended to be a how-to book, but I did want there to be, you know, a little bit of lessons along the way. And the way to structure that really is to look at what were all of my biggest fears before we started this, and what are the most common fears that I hear from other people about the idea of taking your kids to live in another country for 2 months? And they're often the same. Well, I can't take my kids out of school. You know, that's a really common one. And so I just addressed that, and I addressed how we've dealt with that from the start and then through the ages. You know, as the kids go through different stages, things change. But education changes as well. And, you know, the internet has changed everything. Another one is, oh, we can't afford that. People automatically think that we have, you know, a trust fund or all this disposable income, and that that's how we travel. And so it was really important to address that, because one of the things that is eye-opening for a lot of people is that we can go and live in Brazil or Spain for 2 months, and it will be cheaper than if we had stayed at home. And when you put it in that perspective, they're, oh, you know, so you can break down all these barriers to, I can't do that, I could never do that. Well, actually, you could. You might not want to, and that's totally fine. Yeah. But in structuring that book to balance the humor and the engaging story with some sort of takeaway, I really started with, what are people's biggest objections and fears? And what were my biggest objections and fears? And how did I overcome them along the way?
Hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. I guess, you know, you obviously, when you work with your clients, your coaching clients, you obviously have a process you go through. I'm fascinated. Is there a structured process to writing a book? And, you know, what really interests me is, how can you apply, if there is one that works really well, how can you apply that to any sort of writing, whether it be, say, for a podcast episode, or for a blog post, you know, shorter articles, or for videos?
So when I'm writing shorter posts, one of the best ways that one of the things that makes me most efficient in that is to always have a bank of ideas running, so that when I, you know, if I have a block of time to sit down and write a post, I don't have time to sit there and stare at a screen for an hour. So if I have a bank of ideas always kept, you know, then I know where I can pick one and go with it. In terms of a book, I'm very structured with that. And I have the same process every time. So there once was a time where I tried to use fancy software. They have lots of software to help you outline a book and, you know, put your images here and your quotes here and whatnot. And I tried it, and it just was not for me. So I went back to what I had done before, which always worked for me. I don't know why I tried to change it up, but I'm very analog. I'm far more analog than I am digital, which a lot of people are surprised to hear. But I buy a poster board from the grocery store, and then I have a ruler and a pencil, and I section that poster board out into rectangles, and I make each one a chapter, and I list the chapter title, what characters are going to be in this chapter, what location does this chapter take place in, and then I take all the events that I want to write about, and I list them in the different rectangles for each chapter. So when I have all the events in place, Then I go through and I drill it down more and say, okay, this has to happen first, this next, and then I make sure the ending of each chapter will have a tie-in to the beginning of the next chapter. So I do all of this on a poster board with a pencil and a ruler. Like I said, it's very rudimentary. And then I cut out the rectangles, and then I have this card, which is basically my playbook for writing the draft of each chapter. And then when I go to sit down to write, I have that card in front of me and I know exactly what I'm going to write about next. Oh, this scene comes next. This scene comes next. So again, I'm not sitting there wasting time staring at a blank screen. I have a complete blueprint. I know exactly where I'm going. The other way that I structure a book is I write by word count. So if I'm writing the draft of a book, I'll give myself 2 days for that outlining process. And then I'll begin writing 5,000 words per day, not 7 days a week, not even 5 days a week, but 3 to 4 days a week. And I start writing my 5,000 words. I don't stop until I hit that word count. And when you do it in this manner, because you have this outline to work from, you're moving really quickly. And then you get your book draft is done in a matter of weeks. My first book was not this way. My first book took years, you know, but over time finding out what works for me and developing this process, I have it down to a system that causes me a lot less stress and much greater productivity.
Yeah, that's a really nice structure. And as you say, it's something that works for you. So why change it?
I tell people all the time, like, I've taught classes just on the outlining process or just on scheduling your writing. And I say, if that's intimidating to you, knock that 5,000 word count down to 2,000 or 1,000, you know, but you can schedule something and structure it in a way that is manageable for you. And then if you stop thinking about the big picture of the book and just think about the piece that you need to complete that day, you know, that progress over time, eventually you'll realize that you have something.
What's your process for leading into that writing? First of all, I mean, how do you get the idea for I'm going to write a book about this? I mean, I can see where the vagabonding with kids came from. That's personal experience. It was something that, you know, you made sense to write about and share. But how do you come up with other ideas?
Basically, I look at when are the times when I've most made a fool out of myself. And so, like I say, I'm firmly rooted in humor. And it's okay for me to write about other people and make fun of other people in my books, as long as I end up bringing the story back so that ultimately I am the butt of the joke. As a writer, if you're going to do humor, you must always bring it back to yourself. Otherwise, you just kind of look like a jerk. But if you're willing to be authentic and vulnerable and talk about all your flaws and all the things where you just, you know, maybe don't really excel or the reality is different from what you picture in your mind, there's always good material there. And sometimes it's in the, you know, just the little daily acts of life that we find humor. It's not always a grand adventure. Like the vagabonding with books definitely follow the chronology of a trip. You know, we leave, this happens, and then we come back. Some other pieces that I've written, essays for anthologies and the parenting humor series, really, I'm looking for all of those moments, those golden moments, and I'm asking myself, what's behind this? What's at the root of this? How can I explore this deeper and make it something that is relatable to everyone? Because you know what? Everyone has had those embarrassing moments. And that's why, you know, that's why it's so accessible, right? Because we've all been there. But I look for that. And then if I have a collection of those moments, I just look for what's the connection. The same way as when I outline, I look at the end of one chapter and how I'm going to tie it into the beginning of the next chapter. You can do the same thing with the funny moments in life, you know, or the embarrassing moments in life. one always connects to the other. You can always find a connection. And when you do that, you're able to put together a story that really flows one chapter to the next.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that, I mean, to me, that seems like a big unknown to build that connection from a series of what might be short stories or, you know, isolated incidents. Like I did this funny thing today and then I did this other funny thing last week. The two were not really related other than it was me doing it and I made a fool of myself both times. But how do you weave that into a story that's kind of a continuum?
Well, sometimes you can end a chapter with your determination that in the coming week, you will not make a fool of yourself to the degree that you did. But then this happened, you know, and then this scenario came up. There's always a way to tie the things together. One of the tools that I use a lot in humor writing is putting down the internal monologue, just like, and when you're writing it, maybe that part of the text appears in italics so that the writer knows when they read this, oh, this is what she's thinking. But you know, something that happens may be funny, but what really makes it funny is when you get into that person's head and you get to see all of the things that they're thinking and the fears that they're feeling. And when you let people in like that, then you can really get down to it. Because again, that's relatable to everybody. Everybody has been in a situation where maybe they're trying to keep their cool on the outside, but what's going on in their mind is just, you know, crazy. Yeah.
Well, I think that, you know, you raised a point there, which I think above all else is really key. And that's to write in a way that's relatable and that the character, people can actually not only empathize with the character, but kind of almost transform. That character becomes part of them, or they become part of the character in the story.
If you can be authentic enough and real enough and vulnerable enough, then the reader will feel that they know you, you know, because you've let them in. You're not just giving them the version of yourself that you wish you were. You know, you're really letting them into your head, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's some really good advice there for, you know, one of the things I've had lots of conversations about on this podcast is around marketing and in today's digital age and age of marketing automation, how do you keep marketing personal or, you know, human to the level that we all want to be dealing with people rather than robots or artificial intelligence or automated email systems. And I think, you know, the message here is very consistent with how you do that in the marketing world also, is being very authentic and letting people in and relating to people at that human level.
Absolutely. Yeah. Some people present who they hope to be, but it doesn't matter how many screens are between you and another person. People can see inauthenticity right away. It's very apparent. So I say, don't even try it. Just be you, you know, just put yourself out there because that's always going to be your best road.
All right. Now you described earlier about going with a traditional publishing route and not making the headway that you were hoping to make and then heading down the self-publishing. Mm-hmm. I guess with the self-publishing, you'd probably have lots of experience in then marketing that book. So what are some of the things that you learned from that exercise in terms of once the book was published, how did you then market it?
One of the first things that I learned is to throw out all of your expectations, especially first-time authors seem to think that, oh my gosh, I've published this book. I've finally done this amazing thing. Everybody I know will want to buy it. You know, all my relatives will buy it and review it. And you need to take all of those expectations and get rid of them because that's not the way it's going to happen. And even with relatives, you can have, you know, your you can have a cousin with whom you haven't spoken in 30 years and they might become your biggest fan while your mom might not read it, you know? So it's just not going to turn out the way you want it to be. So getting rid of those expectations and understanding that the writers you are trying to reach are probably not people you already know. You are not simply targeting the audience of people you already know. You're targeting an entire mass of readers out there who've never met you, who've never heard of you. Again, authenticity. We can't say that enough. In terms of, like, you know, I think my first book, the first one that made the New York Times, that came out in 2012. So obviously things change a lot every year, but I tried all sorts of stuff. I tried blog tours. I did BookBub ads, which are still very effective, but difficult to get. The number one thing that you have to have coming out of the gate is a really good cover and title. That's something that a lot of people think they've got it. They're like, oh, well, I'm an artist, or I think I've got the idea for this cover. I'm going to design it myself. And I've seen so many people just shoot themselves in the foot for that, like right off the bat, because we can't really be objective about our own work all the time. So it's really good to get an outside opinion, and especially an outside opinion from a professional graphic designer. So that is not something I've ever done myself. I really outsource what I do. So when that first book came out, This Little Piggy Went to the Liquor Store, the cover was very dynamic. It has a vodka bottle and a pacifier on it. So it's like these two conflicting objects. It's very edgy. And then the title is edgy too, having something that people associate with a nursery rhyme associated with liquor store, you know? So you have to have something that's going to catch people's eye, especially when you're starting out. Then from there, you know, pursuing any sort of venue where you can get in front of people with similar interests is huge. That doesn't mean going to a writer's group and trying to sell your book, because all of those writers are also trying to sell their books. And so a lot of times people think, oh, writers, these are my people, they'll buy my books. No, that's just like your family. It doesn't mean just because they're family, yeah, they're going to buy your book. So really understanding who it is you're trying to reach, and then finding the most effective way to deliver your message. And I think a lot of that comes through trial and error. Some people love Twitter. Some people love Instagram. I think it's also a mistake for writers to be like, oh, I have to do this and this and this and this and this. No, you don't have to do those things. You need to find out what is most effective in getting your message in front of your audience. And that doesn't mean that that's the same as what somebody else is doing. Even if another writer is in your same genre and they're having a lot of success on LinkedIn, that doesn't mean that you translate the same way on that platform. So I think recognizing that and not just trying to mimic the successes of the people you admire, but really finding your own way and where you are most comfortable. Any writer who's trying to market themselves on a social media platform on which they are not comfortable is probably not going to reach a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, I think there's one really key message there for me, and I'm probably sensitive to this one, but it's really understanding who your audience is and then having a really captivating message for them, which, you know, starts with the cover and title, but then speaking to them where they're likely to be, where you're likely to find them. And and today, of course, a lot of that is on social media. But so, as you say, some of them may be in one platform versus the other platform.
I also love one-on-one, face-to-face contact. I mean, you know, you can read things till you're blue in the face about scale. And yes, all of that is important. But I think if you're a writer and you really care about the message that you're putting out there, you have to remember that your job is to connect with one reader at a time. If you can make a difference to one reader, make them laugh, make them learn something, cry, whatever, then you are moving in the right direction. I think it's so much more important to focus on that connection that you have with people than to be constantly checking your reviews or checking your numbers, your sales numbers. Like, I know it's difficult not to focus on that, but if you can instead focus on that person-to-person connection, that's what matters. Because you don't want the people who are just going to buy your book and maybe read it, maybe not. You want the person who's going to buy your book, you're going to connect with them, and then they're going to tell everybody they know about this book. For Christmas, they're going to buy 10 copies of your book to give to, you know, you're creating an evangelist there for your work. So yeah. I don't, in this age of scale and internet, I don't want to ever lose sight of the fact that, you know, nothing really trumps that really strong one-on-one connection.
Yeah. And that's great advice. And I think, you know, like the marketing circles that I move in, where we talk a lot about the human marketing, is very focused on that connection. And, you know, I was reading something the other day about email marketing, and it had that message. It said, you know, one topic, one person, one call to action, and very focused on the one person. And also podcasting. I think, you know, a lot of the really good podcasters are now saying, you know, when you're doing a podcast, particularly if it's a solo podcast, you get on and you speak to one person, one listener. And yeah, so that's really good advice. And I think that sort of is a really powerful tool. And as you say, the ripple effect of that, building that connection, can be huge.
That's what you want. That's what you're after. And that concept also translates to when you're writing a book. If you're writing and you're struggling with my audience, what will my audience like? Pick one person. Imagine one person who you know, who you care about, and write to them. Write for them. And that really helps you focus in and get rid of a lot of all that other baggage and move forward.
Yeah, yeah. So the ideal audience concept, ideal audience member, yeah. All right. Now, I mentioned earlier about your podcast series, which is the book one of the Vagabonding with Kids. Was that a conscious strategy? What was your thinking behind doing that first book as a podcast?
When we started traveling and started sort of sharing our journey with other people, not just that we're traveling, but that we're doing it with small children, we're doing it on a budget, I got a lot of inquiries on how did you make that happen? And, you know, like I said before, so much of the, oh, I could never do that thing. And I really want to combat that. I really want to combat this, you know, conventional thinking holding us back from doing amazing things. There's no need for that whatsoever. And so when the book came out, I wanted to make sure that it was accessible in another form as well. And because the podcast is structured with each chapter as an episode, if someone just wants to hear about how to afford something like that, they can do that. If someone just wants to know what the experience is like of taking your kid out of school for a few months and how you navigate that world, they can do that. So it allows different areas to be accessible to maybe people who aren't interested in the book as a whole, but they have one specific area that they want to learn about.
Yeah. Well, it's great, and I certainly encourage people to listen to that, because there's absolutely no cost involved in that other than time, but it is a very entertaining listen.
Thank you.
Now, tell us a little bit then about the nomad lifestyle. I mean, first of all, why did you end up choosing to do that, and what are some of the things that gives you?
So before we had children, my husband and I traveled a lot. I mean, I did my first study abroad to Russia when I was 15. and went back for another study abroad in college. I had the travel bug very early. I was also very interested in languages. I majored in Russian and in linguistics. And then when my husband and I, when we were first married and out of college, we got jobs working in movies and television. So we spent 2 years traveling the world to work on different movie sets and television sets. So that took us to England, Morocco, Spain, Vanuatu, and Palau, and basically living in hotel rooms. And it was an adventure. It was a great opportunity for, you know, people who are young and without children. But it was also contract work, and it came to an end. And when it came to an end, we were kind of ready for it to come to an end as well. Yeah, and so we moved to Idaho, and you know, eventually we started a family, and there was a lot of, I heard a lot of talk like, oh, well, now you'll have to settle down, or now you won't be able to travel as much. And my husband in particular does not like being told what he can't do, or, you know, and we were told a lot of like, oh, once they start school, you can't travel then. And so we really started to examine how was conventional thinking holding us back from different things. What would it be like to raise children, you know, in a family where we travel maybe up to 4 months of every year? And it's not vacation travel. It's living in another country. So a few things that make this happen for us, airline miles, obviously. Everybody knows about airline miles, and we can use them to our advantage to get the plane tickets. And then beyond that, we use home exchange a lot. With home exchange, we also do vehicle exchanges. So, for example, a family of four from Brazil came to Boise and lived in our home and drove our cars for 2 months. And we went to their home and drove their cars for 2 months. So we use the airline miles for the tickets. We swapped homes. We swapped cars. So you've negated the expense of accommodation and in-country transportation. That's how we get to the affordability thing for all of this. But so it's just
the living expenses basically are the same as what you had before on paper, and the difference in cost of living in the countries can work in your favor.
Exactly. Except when we went to Australia. That one was pretty crazy. But over the years, we've
You must have come down when the exchange rate was unfavorable for you.
I think so. It was awesome.
You have to come back now. You have to come back now because I think well, the US dollar is the Australian dollar is only worth 68 US.
Oh, okay. Well, we since then, we've taken our kids to Mexico a number of times because my husband's parents actually live there. Once we enrolled them in a Montessori school down there in Mexico for 3 months as well when they were small. We took them to Thailand. We took them to Brazil, Scotland, Ireland, Spain. When we went to Australia, we were up on the Sunshine Coast for a while, and then we rented a camper van. We had a home exchange for a month. Gosh, we flew into Brisbane and went up north. I can't remember the name of where we were. Not far from Noosa, because we had a friend in Noosa. And then we rented a camper van and worked our way down the coast in the camper van, and then ditched that in Melbourne and took the ferry to Tasmania. Drove way down to the southern tip and spent Christmas there 1 year. When we were in Brazil, you know, we got to be in Rio on for the new year, which is a big deal. We saw Carnival in Sao Paulo. And this is with little kids. So we took our kids to the all-night Carnival, you know, party. But we also got to take them up into the Amazon and do jungle treks and, you know, some really amazing things. So for us, it's just been an incredible way of life. Now, on the other hand, I'm kind of a homebody. When I'm home, I love to be home. You know, it's not like sell everything and backpack around the world. I'm not that type of traveler. And for some people, that works great. For us, this is what works really well. Our kids are very adaptable. The benefits that I see, I mean, of course, traveling is going to broaden your perspective. Like I said, I'm very into languages. So I love exposing my family to as many languages as possible, as many cultures as possible. I don't want my children to grow up thinking that, you know, the world is basically what our neighborhood is, because it's not. Yeah. It's vast and different and beautiful. Travel fosters compassion, curiosity. There are so many benefits to it. And I just can't imagine not doing it. Exploring the world has just been one of the most wonderful things we've done as a family. I'm so grateful that we're able to do it. And I think it's taught my kids a bit of gratitude as well.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned one of the challenges being the education of the children, but I think, you know, the education they're getting through this travel is hugely valuable. And I remember when I was a young kid at school, my parents did a trip to Europe for 4 months and took me and my sister out of school. And they went to see the principal at the time to say, you know, could he put together a program for me to, you know, keep my schooling going while we're over there. And he said to them, look, there's no point. Just make sure that he keeps his eyes and ears open and watches what goes on around him, and that will be the best education he can have in the next 4 months.
I think that is fantastic. And we've had similar experiences with some teachers. The first time we approached teachers and said, we're taking our kids out of school for 2 months, I was terrified, like they're going to slap my hand with a ruler or something.
Yeah.
And the teachers have always been wonderful and really understanding of that this is an education in itself for these children.
Mm, yeah. And as I mentioned earlier, your daughter has her own podcast, and you said YouTube channel as well. I didn't find that one, but I'll have to check that out. And she, you know, speaks to people in all these different countries and has conversations with them about their experience and their perspective on the world, which is fabulous.
Yes, she is not an introvert. So we've been finding ways over the years to help her express herself. And yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is absolutely fascinating, Amanda. I could go on talking travel for ages with you and learning more about the countries, but I guess I'm going to have to put them all on my bucket list and start do more travel myself. I've probably done enough travel in my corporate life, but it's different when you're doing business travel than if you're doing it as a kind of, you know, live in a country and experience the life there for a few months. I think that's fascinating. But it's a good point now, I'm looking at the time, to move on to the Buzz, which is our innovation round, and it's designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got a series of five questions. They're kind of geared to business, but I'm sure that from your experience in business and in writing and in traveling, that you'll have some really great answers for us and inspire people to go and do something awesome today.
I'm ready.
What's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Prioritize their personal happiness. No one is responsible for anyone's personal happiness other than you. I think if your mental, physical, and emotional well-being are not dialed in, then you have not created the space to be innovative.
Mm, yeah, I love that. I particularly love that, you know, your personal happiness is your responsibility. So
absolutely,
just make it happen. All right. Now, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I would have to say to shed all adherence to conventional thinking. We are raised with, this is how it is, this is how things go, this is what you do next. And I think you have to really have a mindset shift to be able to view that as separate and just one line of thinking and not necessarily the truth, the only option. So shedding conventional, recognizing that it's conventional thinking, and then shedding that and looking at things in a new light. That's what I'm going to go with.
Yeah. All right. Great. Well, it certainly opens up other possibilities, doesn't it? And,
yeah.
And I think the risk with the conventional thinking, whilst it might be a safety framework, is that it restricts you. Now, you spoke about the board that you use for structuring your writing. Is that your favorite resource, or do you have another favorite resource you want to share with us today?
I would say my partner, who happens to be my husband, is also a great resource. Your question on what a great tool is, we go have breakfast every morning. And just that time, it's after the kids have gone to school, right? That's our time to think, to brainstorm. And that's been huge. In terms of other products, as I said before, I'm very analog. I am not very digital. And I use a calendar, a paper and pen calendar, nothing on a screen. And doing that, using that and scheduling out like my writing, if I'm working on the draft of a book or whatever I'm going to do in the day, I live by my calendar. It is my Bible. And so that is really important to me. But if I had to throw a digital one in there, I'd say we use Airtable, and that has been very helpful in organizing content and making sure that it is repurposed as needed and goes through the funnels that we've created to get out there.
Mm. All right. That's great. Yeah. I think using a calendar to schedule time and putting tasks into the calendar is huge. That I'm seeing that benefit now. I've switched to another digital tool. I'm doing it digitally, but really scheduling time on my calendar. And one of the things I'm recognizing is I'm taking on too much. You know, when you just put it into a to-do list for the day, you think, oh yeah, I can do all that. And then at the end of the day, you've done perhaps half of it. And what I find then is I do distraction really well, because I get to a point where this is a bit overwhelming, and so you find something to distract yourself. When you start to structure it in the calendar, then suddenly you realize, well, there's no way I can do all this in advance, and then that forces you to prioritize some more. So.
And just that awareness is so important, that awareness of, oh, I can't fit this in a day, you know, and then you get smarter about how you schedule it out. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And what's the best way to keep a project on track when you've got a writing project going?
Well,
and maybe that's it, scheduling it in.
Yes. Also, I would say making the people around you aware of what time and space you might need, especially if you're, you know, if you're a parent, if you have a family, if you have a spouse, anybody else with demands on your time. Making them aware of your situation is very important. You can't get frustrated at them for not giving you the time that you need if you haven't expressed that. You know, again, this is taking personal responsibility for your situation. If you don't let them know, they can't help you. And then in terms of clients, like when I'm coaching people, of keeping them on track, the best thing I can do to keep them on track is understand their individual perspective and their situation and challenges, because everyone's unique. You know, for me, the way I coach, it is certainly not a one size fits all situation. I know I have fellow coaches, very successful coaches who I have great respect for, who do a very regimented system. And I work a little differently because I really want to tailor it to a person's situation. If I can do that and truly understand where they're coming from, then I have a much better shot at keeping them on track and moving forward.
Yeah, I love that approach. It's kind of very much a guide, and you're always there with them rather than you're out at the next step and you're asking them to do things at the next step, but they're still struggling with the previous step, which they need to get done before moving on.
Right.
Hmm. All right. Now, we've touched a little bit on this. What's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Be authentic. There's only one you. So you might as well be that. Be authentic. Be weird if you're weird. And always give first and give without expectation. I think that's huge. The if you go into something with the what's in it for me mentality, you're going to get bitter pretty fast. But if you can just be authentic and give of yourself, you know, without expectation, then the rewards are phenomenal, more than you would ever hope for.
That's great advice. And I think that without expectation is a really big one. And it comes back to what you said in the first question about the personal happiness, because if you give without expectation, then there's no disappointment comes out of that. Whereas if you have a certain expectation and that's not, that expectation doesn't come about, then all of a sudden frustration creeps in and a little bit of regret as to what you did. And yeah.
My husband and I, we work with couples. Like I said, we organize these couples retreats, and that's huge. Like people say, oh, is it like couples therapy? No, forget that. It's yeah. Positivity. It's forward thinking. And it's about, you know, taking responsibility for your personal happiness.
All right. Well, this has been fabulous, Amanda. I really appreciate what you've shared with us today. Now, where can people find out more about you and learn about your books, maybe even purchase some of the books and maybe even get in touch and say thank you for what you've shared?
Sure. So you can find me at businessofus.com. And all of the books are available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Google, iBooks, all of those. But I write as A.K. Turner. So, and I, you know, you can reach me at Amanda@AKTurner, and I love to chat. So, yeah.
Great. Well, we'll put all those links in the show notes so that people can click straight through as well. Now, do you have a kind of big parting piece of advice to leave the listener today, particularly if, you know, their aspirations are to be a leader and be at the forefront of innovation?
I think that it's really important to keep in mind that things don't have to be perfect for you to take the next step. You don't want to suffer from analysis paralysis. And this is a huge one for writers too. It's not perfect. The tough reality is that it's never going to be perfect. And if you do move forward, you will continue to improve and learn as you go. You know, if you never stop learning, I never want to stop learning. But part of that learning process is sometimes just taking that step, even when it's a little bit scary.
Yeah. Yeah. And getting out there and doing something, whether it's, you know, writing a book and getting started with the writing process and sharing your writing with somebody who can then give some feedback, that's actually a key part of the learning. So if you just do the research and keep it all to yourself, you might sort of read a lot of interesting information and absorb a lot of interesting information, but the learning actually comes about when you apply that and share what you've done with it.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, finally then, Amanda, who would you like me to chat with on a future InnovaBuzz podcast and why?
I would love for you to chat with a physical trainer. There is a physical trainer named CJ Thomas, and I will send you his information, but he is doing some really innovative things. He is an excellent speaker, excellent at connecting with the people who come to him for help, and I think he would be a wonderful guest.
Great. Well, we'll get an introduction from you to CJ and get him on the podcast and have a conversation as well.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks so much, Amanda, for sharing your time and insights with us so generously today on the InnovaBuzz podcast. I've really learned a lot. It's been inspirational to hear about your journey and your nomad traveling adventures and how you've made that happen for your entire family without breaking the bank as well, which is really important, I think. And I've really enjoyed it and learned a lot. So I wish you all the best for the future. And if you're ever down in our neck of the woods again, please do reach out. As I say, the exchange rate's probably in your favor at the moment, so it might be worth a look.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Jürgen. And I'm probably going to take you up on that because I'd love to do another trip down under.
Okay. All right. Let's keep in touch then.
Will do.
I hope you enjoyed that engaging and informative conversation with Amanda and took something away from her episode. There are so many parallels in what Amanda shared about book writing with other content production and with marketing in general. In particular, knowing your audience and having the right message for the right audience, as well as that focus on building a connection with just one reader. I'd love to know what you took away from Amanda's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Amanda Turner. That is AmandaTurner. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Amanda Turner. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Amanda there, as well as links to her websites, to her books, to her social media pages, and the other resources we spoke about in today's conversation. Amanda suggested that we have a conversation with physical trainer CJ Thomas on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So CJ, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast courtesy of Amanda Turner. Remember to check out our Marketing Master mini class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and accessible without even giving away your email. But most importantly, it will enable you in less than 30 minutes to gain absolute clarity about who your ideal client is and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. And if you'd like our help to go even deeper into marketing mastery, or our help with producing your very own podcast, even launching your very own podcast if you don't yet have one, then send me an email to jürgen@innovabiz.co and we can set up a quick call to have a short conversation and find out whether we're a good fit for one another. And tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got even more fantastic guests lined up, including James Hayes of Developmental Edge and Zachary Babcock of Underdog Empowerment. Stay connected with us by subscribing to the InnovaBuzz podcast at innovabuzz.com/subscribe. innovabuzz.com/subscribe. Make sure you never miss another episode. It would also mean a lot to me if you leave us a review because what you think matters. I'd love to hear your thoughts, your ideas, your suggestions, or questions you have, so go ahead and share them in the comments below the blog post for this episode. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.